Cyber attacks are a global threat, not only to the economy, but to the entire society and its critical infrastructure. Unfortunately, NGOs and nonprofits are also increasingly among the targets. Only recently, a cyber attack on the International Committee of the Red Cross made headlines. How can NGOs and nonprofits, especially in the humanitarian sector, meet this challenge? We discuss this in today's episode with Clara Jordan, Chief Public Policy Officer, and Adrian Oji, Chief Operations Officer at the Cyber Peace Institute. Welcome to our podcast. I'm your host, Sabine Krümer from TÜV Süd. Hi, Clara and Adrian. Great to have you with us today.
Good morning, Sabine.
Hi, Sabine. Thanks for having us.
Adrian, NGOs and nonprofits are increasingly exposed to cyber attacks. What makes them an easy and attractive target for cyber criminals?
Indeed, NGOs are unfortunately increasingly attacked in cyberspace. First thing to say about that is that it's really a heinous crime. It's a horrible thing to do. And, you know, there was, I think, for many years in cyberspace, the assumption that there were certain assets or targets that were off limits. And we've seen that completely changed over the last few years, in particular during the pandemic, with hospitals being attacked and human life basically being taken hostage by criminals. And that is something that has extended to the nonprofit sector. And so you mentioned the attack against the ICRC, and it's indeed an attack that happened about over a month ago now that has really, I hope, served as a wake-up call in the sector, because NGOs are going to be attacked whether or not, you know, they think that they are a legitimate target. Unfortunately, it's not a matter of if they're going to be attacked, but when. There's a number of reasons as to why NGOs are getting attacked and we fear are increasingly going to be attacked. For starters, they hold valuable assets to criminals. They hold funds, right? Money. NGOs don't run, you know, just on goodwill. They run on budgets that are raised from various donors around the world. I think the humanitarian sector raises something between $30 and $40 billion annually. The entire nonprofit economy raises about $1 trillion. So there's actually a lot of money that's of interest to criminals in that sector, and that they can simply steal. And we've helped a number of NGOs, like Roots of Peace, for instance, an NGO that operates in Afghanistan, helps farmers down there. It was stolen over $1 million in funding with what is called a business email compromise attack. They stole a password, impersonated somebody high in the leadership, and ordered a couple of wires out of the bank accounts. It's an attack that, unfortunately, we see happening increasingly in that sector. But funds and money is not the only interest for criminals. NGOs also hold very sensitive data, actually some of the most sensitive data on the planet. And to connect that with the attack against the International Committee of the Red Cross earlier this year, the data that was stolen there, that is actually currently being sold by those behind the attack on the darknet, related to families that had been dislocated due to wars and migrations and other very unfortunate events. And that program was meant to reconnect those families. So it contains lots of personal data around those families. And some of the people that, you know, have their data in that program are of interest to certain governments. And some attackers are able to monetize that data by selling it to highest bidder. So that's really unfortunate. And really, you know, it's sad and infuriating at the same time. Programs that are meant to do good in the world that are turned upside down by criminals just trying to make money and do harm, basically. But NGOs also had the attack because of interest to, you know, wage disinformation campaigns. There's a lot of activity in the news in Ukraine and Russia. And so there's also political disinformation at play in that sector. And at the end of the day, who's impacted when NGOs are attacked? It's people, right? And NGOs actually protect about 1 billion people worldwide that live in their extreme poverty. And when they are attacked, of course, you know, it's bad for their activities, bad for their staff, but it's actually bad for their own beneficiaries, the most vulnerable people on the planet. So it's not a great prospect, in particular because NGOs don't really have the resources right now to invest in their cybersecurity. Cyber is often thought as a costly activity. We actually don't think that it's necessarily costly, at least every aspect of it doesn't need to be costly. And there are many solutions that can be implemented to improve cybersecurity. They are not necessarily costly. But yeah, today NGOs don't really monitor their networks. I think it's only 1 in 4 that does. They don't really train their staff. They don't really prepare for the future, so they really invest in cybersecurity planning. And the consequence of that is that they're attacked. So you mentioned ICRC, I mentioned Roots of Peace, there's Save the Children, and there is a number of other NGOs that have been targeted. We are actually going to publish very soon some kind of a platform or a map, if you want, of all the different incidents that have hit NGOs around the last 20 years. And you see that it's actually quite a serious issue that's undocumented. That it's not enough talked about, and something needs to change. Saying that they're better and worse attacks, but if we are to think or, you know, envisage a world with cyber peace, which is the mission of our institute, we really need to start protecting the most vulnerable.
So is it a lack of awareness and a lack of budget, Clara? What do you say?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think the first is, you know, that as Adrian mentioned, something very important, that we really lived in a world where when we thought about cybersecurity and operational consequences, we thought about banks or pipelines or power companies or, you know, big tech companies that had intellectual property. But so first of all, it is about that lack of awareness that these organizations are of value and that they too can be attacked by criminals or nation state actors. And then it is a combination of awareness and resources. The awareness is that again, for many years, you know, the way we've seen news coverage, it was all about money, access, you know, that's where we focused our efforts to secure those that have other national sort of security or foreign policy or economic priorities, but not those who provide, you know, that care. So I would say that is the first sort of challenge we have encountered. And then it is a question of resource. You know, cybersecurity is seen as a cost center rather than something enabling an operation of an organization. So really, cybersecurity is a part of a resilience. It's a part of a business continuity. But in the NGOs and in many other sectors, it has been seen as a cost center. And so those organizations, they want to spend their resources on helping the vulnerable populations. They don't want to spend, and they oftentimes don't have the resources. And then, as you know, cybersecurity is oftentimes complex, and it's oftentimes not made accessible to organizations. They don't have a lot or any specialized staff. So it's really a combination of resources, awareness, and make it cybersecurity for these NGOs accessible, easy to use, and thinking about, you know, different ways of doing it. You know, you can't give an NGO a set of threat intelligence data because they wouldn't know what to do with it. So I think this is really changing the conversation as to how should cybersecurity for NGOs look like? You know, is it just another sector that can buy it? We now know very likely not. But, you know, is this a sector that has to have a curated ways of dealing with cybersecurity?
To me, it also sounds like it's absolutely business critical for the NGO sector, and there's still a lot of work to do. So you both work at the Cyber Peace Institute, Clara and Adrian. What is the mission of the Institute, and who is behind it, and how is it funded?
So the Cyber Peace Institute is an independent and neutral NGO. And really, our mission is to ensure the rights of people to security, dignity, and equity in cyberspace. The Institute really was built out of the conviction that really the secure, stable, and equitable cyberspace is really the precondition to cyber peace. And we need cyber peace to unlock the potential of technology. We are an organization that is there to protect the most vulnerable. As we've discussed with NGOs just now, you know, the individuals have been really put in a situation where we have to shoulder absurd levels of risks. And as we've seen over the past couple of years, you know, cybersecurity and individual security are not two separate things. Now cybersecurity touches our lives, you know, in every possible way, whether it's a hospital or a school or an operation of an NGO. And so as the digitization of our lives sort of continues, so do the human consequences and the human impact of cyber attacks. So the Institute was built to really help those vulnerable to bring their voices, their perspective into different fora. and to support these vulnerable communities. The Institute has a very special and unique way of operating. It has three teams. It has assistance team, analysis team, and advancement team. And this assistant team is there, it's the team that Adrian is leading, that is there to support the vulnerable communities. But we do that work and our advancement work, the public policy work, based on analysis that our analytical team provides us. So we can provide really evidence to those conversation as to what is happening to the victims on the ground. And really that evidence-led accountability is key in our work. And I think that's why the Institute was founded, because the community has recognized that we will not defend our way out of the problem, that we need the assistance. We need to bring these perspective to the individuals, to the public policy fora, to the highest level of decision making, because without that, we will not change the current situation. So, you know, the organization was built with seed funding from MasterCard, Microsoft, Ford Foundation, and the Hewlett Foundation. And really, this is the recognition of these leaders, you know, that the care for an individual, care for the whole ecosystem, needs to go beyond sort of their priority equities or their priority investments. It is really that there are those in the ecosystem, that there are communities that are currently on the sidelines, and they need support. So the Institute was born out of recognition of these leaders in industry and philanthropy, that there needs to be an organization that does provide care for those individuals. So in terms of our ongoing funding, the Institute continues to rely on leadership and support those in the industry who want to support this whole ecosystem. So we work with different organizations in the industry, in a philanthropy world, and individuals who want to provide resources to the work of the Institute so we can focus on where we have identified the needs in the communities. We've oftentimes talked about cybersecurity poverty lines in terms of access to technology and access to security. But currently there is very little done to thinking about how we can secure those that can't afford that security. And so our efforts with the NGOs or in the past in the healthcare sector are really to address those needs.
Mm-hmm. Adrian, Clara just described that you're organized in different sections. Now, who can get support from you and what are specific activities?
We help organizations. We help in particular non-governmental organizations that are providing critical services to vulnerable communities. So, of course, organizations that are active in the humanitarian space, but also in development. We focus really at the organizational level. So we help those that help the most vulnerable, because we think that's where we can provide most added value in complement to existing digital assistance providers that exist, such as Access Now, Amnesty Tech, Citizen Lab, to name but a few, that are most active at the individual level. So helping, for instance, human rights activists and journalists. We provide assistance through a network of corporate volunteers called the Cyber Peace Builders. So we work with private organizations around the world that have either a focus on cybersecurity, so cybersecurity companies like Rapid7, for instance, or Microsoft that has a lot of cybersecurity capabilities, or large organizations that have information security staff, like, for instance, we're working with MasterCard, we're working with Inditex, we're working with companies in Telefonica, we're working with companies in the UK, companies in Switzerland, in Belgium, and other places. And we basically ask their staff to volunteer a couple of hours a year to help those NGOs. So we operate, a matching service whereby we curate relationships with NGOs, making sure that they fit within the logic of the network, helping the most vulnerable, basically. We work with them to understand what their security needs are, and then we break down those needs in various jobs, if you want, short-term jobs for a couple of hours maximum. And then we post them on essentially a job board where volunteers from different companies can just come and take a look and figure out, you know, if they've got time and they have the skills, then they can take the job. There's a lot of work that goes in the background. You know, it seems like a simple concept with, you know, a job board and then people just come and match. You know, it's a basic platform like you'd find, you know, eBay or other typical platform with supply and demand. But there's actually a lot of work that goes into the curation of the relationships with the NGOs on one side, which is why we have a network of regional advisors that we are scaling up around the world to help us build trust with NGOs around the world, right? Because when initially you reach out to NGOs in geographies where they haven't heard about us because, you know, we're not part of their traditional circle. First, we operate in cyber. They tend to operate in other sectors. And second, we may come from a different geography where we're still essentially based in Geneva and we work with NGOs around the world. So they may not have heard about us. And when we offer them, you know, hey, we're this NGO providing free cybersecurity service, some NGOs had, you know, questions and even concerns. So having people that, you know, speak their language, share a cultural heritage, and can really broker trust and explain what the mission of the institute is, it helps a lot. So there's a lot of work that goes on that side of the platform, if you want, on the demand side, to create the demand. And then on the other side, we obviously need to be very careful as to who we bring onto that network. You know, we're working with NGOs that are helping the most vulnerable and sometimes the most targeted people on Earth. And so if we were to bring the wrong people to them, we could actually do more harm. Yeah. So there's a lot of thinking that goes into that. We only work with certain companies. We know the volunteers at individual level. We have a fully fleshed out risk management strategy to make sure that we only take people that can do more good than harm. We train them, we onboard them. So there's a lot of work that goes into the background to make sure that this network actually brings value and doesn't endanger anyone.
Mm-hmm. To me, that sounds absolutely fabulous, because when you provide this kind of concrete assistance and support to the NGOs, then this is really beneficiary. And also in practical, you have a kind of application process for companies who want to volunteer?
Yeah, absolutely. So we need to, first of all, like, discuss with them, understand what are their intentions, make it clear what the program is about, and clarify that their staff are actually going to be available a minimum of hours. And we also want to make sure that there's a minimum, you know, commitment on their side in terms of people, so that it's just not, you know, one person and then suddenly like this person loses interest, because there's obviously costs as well on our side. So we want to make sure that people are engaged and committed. We make the company sign a proper contract. You know, there are legal counsel created. There's a lot of legal aspects that go into that process. So it's really like a NGO to business, if you want, or B2B like type of cooperation that is timely. I'm not gonna, you know, tell you the contrary. It takes time to go through different legal hoops and make everyone in the company understand what the program is about and understand, you know, how their volunteers are going to be helping us and through us helping others. Once that's done, then we've got further steps with the individual volunteers. They also have an agreement to sign. They have a code of conduct to sign and to abide to. There's an onboarding process. Obviously, when we talk to companies, we make sure we know who the companies are before. And so there's a process to check, make sure they're not on sanctions lists and things like that. So it's a time-consuming process, but, you know, we've launched this in the last 6 months. We launched that in July, actually, last year.
Oh, so it's brand new.
Yeah, it's new. It's very new. We prototyped the idea in healthcare only in the summer of 2020 with this program called Cyber for Healthcare. And then we expanded into the Cyber Peace Builders a year later and opened it up internationally 14th of October last year. So it's very fresh. That being said, we've got about 20 corporate partners now. We've got about 30 NGOs that are currently getting serviced right now in the network. We've got about 50 volunteers that are onboarded and active and, you know, hopping on calls and telling NGOs what second factor authentication is about and, you know, why they should implement DMARC and things like that. So it's growing slowly, but steadily. And this is how we want to grow. We don't want to grow exponentially fast. We want to take our time, make sure that we provide value to the NGOs first and foremost. Second, make sure that we provide value to the volunteers to keep them engaged and committed. Provide value to their companies, to their employers, to make sure that they're going to keep on sending us volunteers, you know, because there's competition at least in this field. Lots of companies have volunteering programs and their volunteers could go and do something else. So we also need to make sure the value proposition for them is good. And so we grow, you know, steadily. Our objective this year is to get to about 100 NGOs through about 300 volunteers.
Clara, you are the chief public policy officer. How do you convince political stakeholders of your goals?
You know, it's one of the hardest undertaking that I've done in my career. You know, at the Institute, we really do this work through the evidence. We call it the evidence-led accountability. So we really work with facts that Adrian's team and our analysis team give us. And we formulate it in recommendations, advocacy point, and public policy positions. I think that the most important message here is that what happens to the victim is happening. It's an outcome of an action or omission of someone. And so to these individuals, you know, someone owes them something or someone has acted to harm them. And so we recall the responsibilities, you know, that every government, every decision maker has towards its citizens. In cyberspace, you know, it's not only just your citizens within your jurisdiction. You know, there is a really growing scholarship that talks about how this is a responsibility for all the individuals because of the interconnected nature of the internet. So really the way we work and we advocate to the political stakeholders and decision makers is to discuss the facts on the ground and how these facts really, you know, work in the context of their responsibilities. The primary responsibility of any government is to protect and provide. And if we contextualize this obligation to protect and provide, for example, in the healthcare sector, that really recalls them and helps them understand their responsibilities. But we also show them the facts on the ground and whether the way, you know, that they are protecting the healthcare sector or NGO sector, how the reality looks on the ground. As you know, the policymakers and the stakeholders, you know, they have a range of equities to take into considerations when they are taking decisions. In the past, we focused, I think, disproportionately on national security, foreign policy, or economic sort of priorities. They're all important. I mean, every individual benefits from a stable geopolitical environment. But really, those human equities, the impact on the individual, the perspective of the individual, has not been at the forefront. And so the way we work with these stakeholders, you know, is that we bring that perspective to them and say, when you will be deciding on a host of issues, think about the individual. If you're thinking about whether you will call out an attack on an NGO, think about the consequences an attack on NGOs can have. I think ultimately what policymakers need to understand that, again, they have the obligation to protect and provide, that, for example, access to healthcare is a human right. And, you know, we've seen so many attacks on the healthcare sector over the past, you know, two and a half years and even before. And so we say, look, you know, by not doing what needs to be done to protect the healthcare sector, whether it's on a political level, holding someone accountable, or investing the right ways in cybersecurity, or thinking about the right sort of technical policy and standard issues, you are actually not fulfilling your obligation to protect the individual, because if there's a ransomware attack on a hospital, how are you as a government ensuring that the individual has access to the healthcare? So it's really through the contextualization of obligation, through recalling them. And I think that the very last point on this issue is that ultimately, you know, governments are the ones that are using digital tools to provide better services to their citizens and sort of work globally. They will not be able to do this. They will not be able to digitalize. They will not be able to provide those services to individuals unless those individuals trust the technology. And if a government gives a solution to an individual that cannot be trusted, how can the individual trust in the government at the end of the day? Because it's a government service we're using, and sometimes we are being victimized by it. So it really goes into the way individuals see the government, trust it as a protector provider. And then, you know, really that is the cybersecurity underpins everything the government is trying to do with individuals vis-a-vis citizen economically, when it comes to science, technology, you know, education, healthcare. So it really goes into discussing with them what is ultimately at stake.
Mm-hmm. So trust is really a key factor when it comes to new technologies and using them for the well-being of society. Clara, the Cyber Peace Institute has recently become an associated partner of the Charter of Trust, which is an alliance of global companies for more cybersecurity. Why is it important for you to be represented here, and what impulses will you contribute?
The main motivation to join and to collaborate with the companies that are in a Charter of Trust is a shared ambition. I think both the organization in Charter of Trust and us really see that, you know, we need to take this long-term approach in the service of public interest. And I think that is really the shared ambition, shared goal, is really thinking long-term, working together in a public interest. where the Institute's work has been, and Adrian mentioned it with the Cyber Peace Builders, is actually bringing together leaders from different sort of sectors and to work together in a multi-stakeholder manner to securing the ecosystem. And so, you know, for us, the sure view and the recognition of the fact that we need to act proactively was the reason why we joined. You know, we want to work together with the companies in a charter of trust in the interest of individuals. The charter of trust companies, you know, they are doing it really via best practices, security by design, securing the supply chain, and all these other really important initiatives they have taken. What we want to bring to the table is really to show them how that individual at the end of the chain of our sort of digital world can suffer, or just when they are making those decisions, bringing that incentive to thinking about, okay, how is this going to secure, you know, the consumer? I mean, the charter of trust companies use the word consumer. We work, you know, with the terminology saying individual. But for us, those impulses are there that we want to bring into the discussion is to say, okay, think about the individual at the end. Let's always think about what is the ultimate goal of all the initiatives that are you taking. If you're taking the supply chain security issue, for example, let's really think through how at the end of the day, the consumer, the individual is going to be protected better. Are there different ways we can think about it to ensure that there is more protection of the individual? So for us, it's important to bring those perspectives to the conversations. We are also really hoping to bring the perspectives of the group of companies into some of the very high-level policy discussions we are leading or we are taking on, in particular at the UN level. It's very important that this is an ecosystem where every stakeholder has a very important set of insights. And so we're trying to bring the also insights from the industry and what they are doing and the best practices and understanding of the threat, you know, into those policy conversations at the highest levels. Because it's really important that those perspectives have to be really mirrored. And if we have a shared set of ambitions with Charter of Trust companies, then we can really advocate together for really a better, safer ecosystem, really that the one that prioritizes the individual.
Mm-hmm. Sounds really like a good plan and a good match. Adrian, in a nutshell, what are the most important things that NGOs should consider to protect themselves from cyber attacks?
I like to think that cybersecurity really comes first with the right mindset, and that starts with the leadership. I'm sure you're familiar with the idea that cybersecurity has gone from the server room to the boardroom in the private sector in the last decade or so. That transition hasn't happened yet in the NGO world, and it needs to. So I think the very first thing is to recognize the strategic importance of cyber in creating digital trust with the NGO beneficiaries and donors and ecosystem. And so that first recognition that despite being an NGO, we are likely to get targeted by cyber attackers, the root of the cybersecurity journey in the sector. The second thing is really to identify the particular threat landscape of NGOs, which differs from SMEs, from large corporations, from governments, and it differs in between different NGOs, right? An NGO that is very active in the space of disinformation is not likely to be targeted by the very same threats as an NGO that is active in child protection, for instance. And so understanding the type of adversaries that one is facing, but also the type of digital assets that an NGO has, and that could be a potential interesting target for malicious actors, is paramount. So really taking a step back and looking at what could happen. The third step in the private sector that is already well understood, it's really training staff, making staff understand what are the threats, how they can penetrate the NGO, how, you know, will criminals try to infiltrate networks and impersonate colleagues, and really make them aware of this threat. And that's something that we see working really, really well. So there's lots of NGOs, for instance, that are starting to do amazing things in that space. They're doing, for instance, phishing competitions, right? Monthly phishing competitions in NGOs to really raise awareness among staff. And obviously not all NGOs are doing that, and more should, so that the staff becomes really the first line of defense. that's not going to be enough. And so obviously there's a technological angle, and yes, there will be some investments there and spendings that will need to be made, and discussions with donors will need to happen. But investing in just monitoring what is happening on one's network, which is not always the case right now, is a fourth very really critical step, so as to understand where are the holes, how to patch them, and, you know, just get rid of attackers. I think the average time an attacker stays in a business network is about 200-220 days, and those are the latest stats from 2021. So in NGOs networks where, you know, there's very little monitoring happening, it may be years before an attacker gets detected. So having some plans in terms of how to react to an incident, so getting those plans drafted up and tested regularly, so exercising is paramount. And to do all that, obviously, programs like the Cyber Peace Builders can help. So we're there to help NGOs kickstart their journey in cybersecurity. We're not there to replace other offerings and, you know, for them to outsource their cybersecurity to us. And we've had NGOs that actually asked us if we could provide them with 10 volunteers for the next 3-4 years on a permanent basis. This is not what we're doing. We're just there to provide a little push, and in particular raise awareness amongst the leadership so that the right priorities are then set for the entire organization. It is not necessarily complex, right? Yes, it takes time, but it is paramount nowadays when NGOs are providing services to their beneficiaries in part through digital technologies that they invest in building digital trust as well. It is part actually of their, you know, of their responsibilities towards their beneficiaries.
You just said that it takes time, but the cyber threat landscape is developing very fast. So in the mid and long term, what are the challenges for NGOs waiting out there?
Yeah, so threats develop fast and attackers are quick to react. But if you look in the grand scheme of things, basic risk management will still apply, right? Figuring out what are your assets, what are technologies you use, if your staff is going to be empowered enough to detect when something is wrong. Those are basic things that have been, you know, going on in industry for the last 20 years and that do work. Sharing IOCs, indicators of compromise, having shared resources to notify, warn each other when something is likely to happen. Those things do work and make it a lot more difficult for attackers to win. And so just elevating a little bit the level of complexity for attackers, basically the costs to attackers, is very likely to deter the large majority of them. That is not going to deter governments and very advanced adversaries, but it's going to deter the majority of criminals out there. Like, we heard recently of an NGO that got ransomed by a group of criminals. And when the criminals realized that it was an NGO, instead of, you know, saying, all right, forget about it, they said, all right, let's provide you with a discount. So you pay just a little bit less. And, you know, that shouldn't happen. And if NGOs actually had that level of cybersecurity maturity a little bit elevated, that wouldn't happen. So to me, there's three key things that in the midterm should happen for the sector to get better. The first is really to look at their own, each NGO, to look at their own networks and staff and practices and really realize that all the trust that they have built over the last decades and sometimes centuries on the ground, you know, sometimes in conflict zones, that trust can completely disappear in an instant if there's a cyber attack that's disrupting their activities, that's disrupting the help that they provide to their beneficiaries, to vulnerable people, if data is being stolen and things like that. So really realizing this and investing in putting in place mitigation measures, controls, and really elevating the barriers for attackers is really like midterm what absolutely they need to be investing in. The second thing is, and I think Clara touched upon this, is really this multi-stakeholder approach. There's a reason why NGOs are there, right? It's because governments are not doing their job. They're not protecting and providing, as Clara was saying. And that's why many NGOs are there, to protect and provide when governments aren't there or the private sector isn't there. This isn't to say that there shouldn't be cooperation, multi-stakeholder cooperation, right? And bearing in mind that there will be difficulties with, you know, in certain regions, with certain regimes, we still think that coming up with a multi-stakeholder approach where certain governments that have certain data could share that with the NGOs, certain private sector companies, like they do with the Cyber Peace Institute, right? Some private companies give us data feeds that we can then use to share with NGOs and let them know when they've been attacked. So those types of cross-sectorial cooperation needs to happen in order for NGOs to really elevate barriers for criminals, because they try and do it on their own and try from scratch, you know, it's going to take more time. And we're there, the institutes there, the private sector can help, some governments can help, some regional organizations can help. And there are activities in that space, like CiviSearch, like NetHope, like ongoing discussions about setting up an ISAC and other services to really have that kind of cooperation really going on in civil society. And we think that there's developments there that are needed, and traditionally there's been a little bit of siloing in the civil society space that, you know, with the right precautions in mind, can really make a difference. And perhaps the last thing is really looking at it from long-term perspective, the systemic perspective. It's introducing these discussions with donors, making them realize that when they give funding to NGOs, asking them to spend 9 cents of a dollar, the vulnerable community that the NGO is protecting, they're actually maybe preventing the NGO from securing the data of their beneficiaries, the vulnerable people they're protecting, and they're actually putting them more at threat. And so unrestricting a little bit the funds that should go into cyber for NGOs could actually help long-term. There's maybe discussions to be had in terms of NGOs that provide critical services, right? If you think of critical infrastructure operators in the developed world, they enjoy some of the benefits that either a state can offer or regional organizations can offer. And so could there be some kind of statuses for NGOs out there to benefit from some level of shared protection that could be a way forward? And I think the really like last thing, and it is important for us to introduce that notion, is really the idea of accountability. Clara touched upon this. It's really inherent to the vision of the Institute. A long time, we've just accepted that NGOs are trying to do good, and, you know, that is good in itself. Although that we need to empower that, and, you know, we need to continue empowering this idea of goodwill and giving back and helping others, I think we also need to introduce the notion of responsibility, because in digital space, unfortunately, if NGOs aren't able to protect well enough their data, the assets, or their funding, they may actually create more harm than good in the long run. And so, although we absolutely need to help them get there, they need to help themselves as well. But I think we also need to introduce some notion of responsibility and accountability also in that sector.
Clara and Adrian, thank you both for the discussion and for being our guests today. Good luck and success in your future work with the Cyber Peace Institute.
Thank you, Sabine. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Sabine. Thanks for having us.